Chapter 25. Byproducts of the Rum Racket. When the ripples of the bird expedition had died out of New York Harbor, I endeavored to promote an excursion into South America. My objective was to search for Inca treasure dumped into a sacrificial lake in the hinterland of Venezuela. The difficulty, however, lay in finding backers. In the first instance, a personal friend, Ralph de Milhau, a wealthy New York stockbroker, had promised to finance the venture, but already the sinister shadow of the economic slump was slowly creeping over the land. So we agreed to postpone the expedition until conditions showed some sign of improvement. Later, not to be outdone, I organized a pleasure cruise to the Bay of Whales, Antarctica, with Count Felix von Luckner, the chivalrous commerce raider of the World War, whose exploits form some of the most romantic incidents in the annals of naval filibustering. The cruise instantly gripped the imagination of a section of the American public. On more detailed consideration, however, we decided that the yacht Mopilia was much too slow for the lengthy and hazardous voyage. As a result of the publicity of these proposals, my name came to be bandied about as that of a competent seafarer. I was not unduly surprised, therefore, when one evening a mysterious phone call summoned me to a shipyard in the environs of New York Harbor. I was not surprised when I received an offer from a rum-running syndicate. Already I had turned down several such offers during the past few years. Would I take over command of a rumboat equipped with 3 Liberty motors? She was about 60 feet long, with a capacity of 600 cases. I accepted with alacrity. Like most of the veterans of the bird party, I was almost destitute of funds. That state of affairs did not exist for long. 1 week with the rum syndicate, and I had made more money than all I received for 2 years under the banner of science. A sketch of the modus operandi of purchase and delivery of booze might not be out of place here. Actually, the whole business of rum barter, from distillery to consumer, is quite elementary. It is in the final delivery, from ship to shore, where the greatest risk is involved, and, incidentally, where the price takes a jump of 800% or more. Agents for the rum racket and the distillers usually meet in New York or Montreal to discuss terms, labels, quantity, etc. Business is on a strictly cash basis. Counterfeit funds are occasionally slipped over on a green distiller or a credulous captain, but it is the exception which proves the rule. It happened frequently when Rum Row was in its heyday, but business methods in liquor smuggling have changed considerably. At first, the big liquor syndicates sent expert samplers and agents to Scotland, France, or Germany, supplying them with sufficient capital to buy liquor. It was a precarious system, however, and the distillers played a few expensive jokes on the liquor ring, making the rum investors a little more wary. Now the mountain must come to Mohammed, or at least meet him in Montreal. Huge quantities of liquor are shipped to Saint-Pierre-Miquelon, a small French island south of Newfoundland, or to Nassau in the Bahamas. Saint-Pierre has the advantage of being nearer the biggest liquor market, and most of New York booze comes from this island in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. Most of my own bootlegging adventures were concerned with Saint-Pierre and the coast of Long Island. At Saint-Pierre, the liquor is taken out of the cases and wrapped in burlap to facilitate the handling on schooners, speedboats, and trucks. It increases the hazard of breakage, but bags are less conspicuous in handling and sink when jettisoned or thrown overboard to destroy evidence. Rum running is conducted on an enormously big business plan. Several of the big shots treated our crew with tolerable fairness, though it was not the usual practice. Influence reaches higher in local and state government than most citizens imagine. The day of the small independent is past. A few large rings control most of the imports, and it is by no means healthy to compete with them. Small operators can buy anything from 5 to 5,000 cases, and they take a middleman's profit, which is rather substantial. Liquor carrying from St. Pierre to the vicinity of Long Island is ordinary freightage, although a few booze pirates found it profitable to hijack schooners at sea. I recall one instance where a young Swede taking a fast boat intercepted a ship en route for the Jersey coast. Offering to buy 50 cases of rye whiskey, he dickered alongside the schooner until a satisfactory price was agreed. At this juncture, he was invited aboard to test a sample. The Swede, knowing the rum racket from stem to stern, accepted the invitation. The schooner carried a machine gun as insurance against piracy, and throughout the negotiations, the gunner stayed at his post. All went well until the Swede came down the companionway. Then, with a sudden sweep of his wrist, he whipped out a Colt and shot the machine gunner through the head. In less time than it takes to tell, he had murdered a further six of the crew and, with his colleagues waiting in the boat, landed the cargo in the vicinity of Cape Cod. Three times he repeated this stunt, and each time succeeded, resorting to an old device of the sea criminal to cover his tracks. Weighting the bodies, he sank them, then scuttled the ship after unloading the booty. I had the doubtful pleasure of meeting the Swede. He was a typical square-headed sailor with a boyish complexion and disarming smile. But there was no mistaking the lusterless, cold blue eye of the killer. I got the story from a Confederate whose tongue was loosened under the persuasion of a bottle of mum. The facts were, however, known all along Rum Row. Such hijacking at sea is exceedingly rare now. Most of the barter is done on land, the ship, cargo, speedboats, trucks, and landing crews all belonging to the same ring. The Swede would not be so fortunate today if he attempted to hijack a schooner from Lunenburg or St. Pierre. When I made my debut in the rum running in the summer of 1930, the profits to be made were substantial, but the stuff was falling gradually in price. Economics are more effective in curtailing liquor consumption than all the revenue agents and coast guards in the country. The byproducts of rum running are unique. The Beret Vogue started in this country when a rum runner smuggled in a big shipment of the French headgear. Chink smuggling is a riskier business than liquor smuggling, and many a Chinaman lies on the bottom of the ocean not far from New York. When the chink runner reaches the danger zone, the yellow freight is manacled together in groups of six by leg and hand irons. Should a revenue cutter heave in sight, the wretched Chinamen are jettisoned without compunction. This abhorrent racket flourishes off the coasts of New York, Cuba, and California. The price paid for smuggling a chink is usually from $500 to $1,000 a head. It is paid by a tong leader. If the chink comes through the ordeal, he is a serf until he pays his master back in wages earned in a restaurant or laundry chain. Only a few rum runners, however, attempt to mix chink smuggling with their regular occupation. There is a distinct cleavage between the landing gangs of the rum rings and the crews of their ships. The beach stevedores are a motley bunch, recruited in pool rooms and gang hangouts. Few of them are sturdy men, and it was laughable to watch Bowery bravos trying to handle a small boat in the surf. The beach gangs work under a padrone system. The leader receives a flat fee of $100 for himself and $25 a man per night. Running between the schooner and the drop, or landing place, I carried some of these toughs back and forth to help in the handling of the cargo. In a choppy sea, they were useless, falling instant victims to mal de mer. Occasionally, romance breaks into this inglorious business. One day, I was running for the beach under cover of a light mist. On board lay 2,500 cases of Scotch and rye. 90 miles offshore, we sighted a tiny sailing vessel bearing down on us. I turned my binoculars on the craft, wondering what had brought such a toy so far from land. Coming closer, I saw it was a yawl of about 35 feet, with her ensign flying jack down, a signal of distress. The jumpy nerves of rum runners are proverbial, and immediately we suspected a ruse on the part of the coast guard to catch us. Our craft was American registered and therefore not protected by the 12-mile limit. I held my course, awaiting developments. At the same time, another rum boat, the Semiramis, under Canadian registry and returning empty from the beach, hove in sight. I altered my course to run close alongside my confrère, and when abreast with him at close quarters, seized a megaphone and roared an order that he should investigate the mysterious stranger. Old MacDonald, the skipper of the Semiramis, hollered back an affirmative and headed for the yawl. When he got close, his glasses picked out the crew of the small vessel, letting go of the mainsail and jib halyards. The sails went flapping and splashing overboard. Obviously something was wrong, but I restrained my curiosity. The rum racket is a highly organized business, and I was working on a strict time schedule. After a successful run inshore with my valuable cargo of contraband, I returned to the schooner and made fast alongside. Then, jumping aboard, I demanded to hear the solution of the distressed yacht mystery. After greeting the captain, we went down below into his cabin. Here he introduced me to a beautiful and cultured Southern belle and her lover, who was not so attractive or cultured. In truth, he was a pasty-faced gigolo who had skipped off with this Georgia maiden, leaving her wrathful father searching the country for them. How they got so far north in that boat is a mystery. The lady pleaded for us to land them on the Long Island coast, and unable to resist her, I radioed to headquarters asking permission to help Cupid in distress. This was curtly refused. The frustrated Juliet sobbed bitterly, and because I can never remain unaffected in the presence of a woman's tears, I promised to take her in if she would disguise in overalls and grease her hands and face. I would take her companion in on the next trip. I explained that it would be a difficult job to smuggle her past the Coast Guard and fool my boss. She, however, refused to part from her love, and I left with another load. A week later, when I got back to the schooner, she had regretted her decision. Food on a Canadian blue nose is notoriously poor, and the diet of salt fish and potatoes grew noxious. Once more, I radioed for permission to land them, but again was refused. It grieved me to refuse her again, so I sent the wretched pair up to Nova Scotia on the schooner. The captain tried to recoup himself by seizing the 30-foot yacht, but lost her in a heavy blow in the Bay of Fundy. I heard afterwards that the strange couple came to New York by steamer. As a rule, rumboat skippers are just good boatmen. My crew were all men of high caliber. The chief engineer was formerly the chief of an oil tanker running from New York to Buenos Aires, and he knew how to get the most out of our two diesels. The chief's assistant was an aviation mechanic who had resigned a commission in the Naval Flying Division. The radio operator served 8 years in the United States Navy as chief petty officer. He was constantly on the alert, despite the terrible weather, maintaining a constant liaison with the operator on shore. Life on a rumboat is no sinecure. There is no haven against dirty weather, and the majority of our operations needed the cover of fog, storm, and darkness. Our men drank champagne to conserve the fresh water supply which was needed for cooking. But in all my experience of rum running, I never drank a thimbleful of liquor myself. The only time that I was caught by the Coast Guard was with an empty ship. We were arrested for not having two copies of the pilot rules in the wheelhouse. I had one set in full view, but nevertheless we were hauled into the Coast Guard base at Staten Island. While under investigation, the ship was looted at the Coast Guard station, and there was no redress for anyone. Fortunately, I had taken off the sextant and chronometer, but all the men's clothing, their personal belongings, the carpenter's set of tools valued at $500, and sundry gear were missing. They could not hold us on the flimsy pretext, and the ship was freed. It cost more than $700 to replace the stolen implements, and my protests against the brigandage were answered by a blank expression and a shrug of the shoulders. Revenue forces in America have developed into training schools for smart bootleggers, an ousted prohibition agent, is the hardest bootlegger to catch because of his experience. Likewise, at sea, the shrewdest rum fleet captains had their training in the Coast Guard. Rum and prohibition have destroyed the high ideals of a body of seamen who had a fine tradition in their appointed task. I admired the Coast Guard cutter as an enemy and loathed him as an ally. One honorable Coast Guard spurned $10,000 and prevented us from landing 2,000 cases right on a New York City pier.